Your North Carolina Reading Service provides the following program for our blind and print-impaired audience. It's the Indie Week, read today by John Fetterson. This issue, dated November 3, 2021. Today's music was pre-recorded at an undisclosed location by an anonymous musical group, who, by the way, have a new album to be released sometime in the near future for Redacted Records. Thank you, folks. I'll begin from the online issue of Indie Week, copyrighted on November 4, the day that I'm reading this, rather than the 3rd when the print edition came out. Republican lawmakers take on diversity training and decry indoctrination at UNC Chapel Hill. In a letter this week to UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Kevin Guskowitz, House Majority Whip John Hardister, Republican of Guilford, cited a piece in Carolina Review, the campus conservative publication, about the UNC Office of Fraternity and Sorority Life mandating a training with the group Social Responsibility Speaks. Hardister wrote, "Some of the contents of this training include the claim that we are on stolen land in North Carolina, the claim that grocery stores are oppressive because not everyone can reach the top shelf, that airlines are oppressive because not everyone can fit into an average-sized seat, that our society disempowers or sometimes harms people who are left-handed, that whiteness and white privilege pervade our society, and that whiteness and white privilege can be juxtaposed with other tenets of oppression." Hardister went on to say that some of the students claimed that they felt guilty or convicted after the training. "This is shameful," he said. "It's reckless and irresponsible to promote the theory that a person, in this case a college student, should feel guilty simply because their skin is a certain color. The university should not require, quote, toxic, politically motivated theories that result in social discord," he wrote, "but should instead be, quote, a warm, welcoming environment that offers a diversity of perspectives to all students rather than mandating divisive ideological programs." As chair of the NC House Education Universities Committee, Hardister asked Guskowitz to justify the training and for information on its cost and how it was paid for. He also asked Guskowitz whether he will take steps to prevent programs like it in the future, and whether his administration has, quote, a plan to address concerns related to politically motivated indoctrination on campus, both in the classroom and in university-sanctioned organizations. "Are you concerned about people losing confidence in our education system due to incidents like this?" he asked. Hardister's letter was co-signed by more than 50 House members and 15 state senators. NC House Speaker Tim Moore and NC Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger were not among the signatories. The letter, copied to the UNC Board of Governors, UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees, and UNC President Peter Hans, is indicative of the current conservative movement against diversity training and objections to ways in which the nation's racial history is discussed at public schools and universities. Republicans across the country have seized on this theme this political season, encouraged by conservative political activists who have been open in their desire to make such targets, quote, the perfect villain in political campaigns. Conservative activist Chris Rufo, who first popularized the idea of gathering conservative talking points under the umbrella of critical race theory, has written and spoken openly about his motives in doing so. He wrote on Twitter earlier this year, "We have successfully frozen their brand, critical race theory, into the public conversation and are steadily driving up negative perceptions. We will eventually turn it toxic as we put all of the various cultural insanities under that brand category. The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. we have decodified the term and will recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions that are unpopular with Americans. In a June interview with The New Yorker, Ruffo was more expansive about how and why he chose critical race theory, a term for a relatively obscure area of study not even encountered by most postgraduate students, as the perfect catch-all for conservative grievances with respect to history and literature curricula, diversity training, and a variety of public policies. "We've needed new language for these issues," Ruffo told The New Yorker. Quote, "Political correctness is a dated term and, more importantly, doesn't apply anymore. It's not that elites are enforcing a set of manners and cultural limits. They're seeking to re-engineer the foundation of human psychology and social institutions through the new politics of race. It's much more invasive than mere correctness, which is a mechanism of social control, but not the heart of what's happening. The other frames are wrong, too. Cancel culture is a vacuous term and doesn't translate into a political program. Woke is a good epithet, but it's too broad, too terminal, too easily brushed aside. Critical race theory is the perfect villain," Ruffo said. The political right has seized on the idea with enthusiasm, passing and pursuing laws that ban certain books from being taught in public schools or being carried in libraries. Last month, the Johnston County School Board passed strict rules about how race and historical issues could be presented after its Republican-dominated County Board of Commissioners threatened to withhold $8 million in funding until policies were put in place to prevent critical race theory from being taught in county classrooms. School officials says it wasn't being taught there. Under a new set of policies in the country, it required that, quote, "all people who contributed to American society will be recognized and presented as reformers, innovators, and heroes to our culture. Teachers not complying with that policy may be disciplined or fired." The conflict has erupted at public universities across the nation as well, including at UNC Chapel Hill, where this over the summer, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones turned down a tenure offer from the school to teach at Howard University. She made the decision after conservative activists, prominent donors, and members of the school's board of trustees tried to prevent her hiring and then her tenure over objections to her work on the 1619 Project and her writing on the issue of reparations for Black Americans. Conservative opposition to concepts taught at public universities and the writing of prominent academics has become a national controversy. At the University of Florida, at least three professors were told they were not allowed to testify in lawsuits challenging controversial state voting laws. But at Florida International, a public university, a professor got the green light to testify in a court case in order to defend the state's voting laws. This week at the National Conservatism Conference in Orlando, Florida, Ohio author and Republican U.S. Senate candidate J.D. Vance touted the wisdom of former President Richard Nixon, saying, "The professors are the enemy." Vance has himself been a scholar in residence in the Ohio State University Department of the Ohio State University Department of Political Science. All right. Also from the online edition of Indie Week, will a small-time raise and one-time bonus be enough to keep school staff from quitting, writes Jasmine Gallup. In an effort to stave off the bus driver's strike and keep school employees from quitting in droves, the Wake County Board of Education approved a one-time bonus and small raises for teachers and school support staff on Tuesday. Full-time employees will see a $1,250 bonus this month, and part-time employees will see a smaller bonus. The board also approved a pay increase to $13 per hour for roughly 1,600 employees, and a 1% increase to the local supplement that the county pays towards teachers and other certified staff, including guidance counselors and therapists. The extra pay comes after almost 2 years of employees being overworked due to the coronavirus pandemic. As children returned to school this year, reports emerged of teachers working 60 or 70 hours a week, grading papers after school, lesson planning on weekends, and acting as substitutes during their free periods for staff who had already resigned. Tensions came to a head Friday when bus drivers, who had been driving double or triple their usual number of routes without extra pay, called out en masse to demand better working conditions. The informal strike continued today, despite the board approving pay raises on Tuesday. Although the protest has lost some momentum, about 30 drivers called out sick Wednesday, many saying that the extra pay is not enough, reported WRAL. Superintendent Kathy Moore emphasized these pay increases are just the, quote, first step in increasing compensation for teachers, but vague promises of better pay in the future are not assuaging employees. The North Carolina Association of Educators held a protest outside the board meeting Tuesday night demanding, at minimum, a $2,000 hazardous pay bonus for all staff, extra pay for extra duties, and raises for all district employees. Board members seem to agree the steps taken Tuesday are not enough. During the meeting, board member Karen Carter questioned how long employees would be willing to wait for better pay. She said, "Keeping staff dangling out there saying, just stay with us, is very hard to do. Look at other districts that have already made significant changes that staff can see." Carter's concerns were backed up by a slew of comments from teachers and staff who reiterated they are overworked, underpaid, and exhausted. Teachers and instructional assistants said they had to regularly fill in as subs to cover vacant positions. Stacy Alesco, a middle school teacher, said she and her co-workers were waiting on a decision from the board to decide whether or not to resign. Carter said she wanted the district to raise pay to at least $15 per hour so experienced nurses, instructional assistants, and other non-beginning staff would be included in the raise. In Wake County, a nursing assistant's starting salary is $11.11 per hour. For an instructional assistant, $11.80. Even with a 13 per hour pay increase, those beginning employees would still be making than the average Raleigh cook or line worker. According to data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, bus drivers who start at $15 per hour make less than the average Raleigh secretary or fast food manager. Board Chair Keith Sutton said the district wishes they could do more, but needs the help of the state to make significant changes to teacher and staff pay. Board member Jim Martin said it was time to play hardball, suggesting that district use one-time COVID relief dollars to provide ongoing salary increases and dare the state not to replace the funding when the federal money is gone. Either way, it's unlikely the state will make a big investment in education, even after COVID-19. After all, legislators are still holding off on meeting their Leandro obligations. Lee Toss with our first news article from the print version, North Carolina, called Three Ring Circus. Wake County State Senator Wiley Nickel's red and blue markers squealed into the microphone as he circled dots on a cardboard cutout in the legislature's redistricting committee meeting on Monday. The rudimentary gerrymandering lesson would have been comical if it wasn't based in fact. Despite North Carolina's near 50-50 split between Republican and Democratic voters, the congressional map GOP officials had drawn ensured them a majority of 11-3 or 10-4. "The most important question is very simple," said Nickel. "How greedy are you going to be with these maps?" Republicans Monday maintained the maps were drawn fairly in the most transparent process to date. The three new maps for U.S. congressional districts and the state House and Senate are expected to pass by party line vote this week. In terms of partisan fairness, the Princeton gerrymandering project gave the congressional map an F, finding it gave Republicans a significant advantage at the polls. State law doesn't give Governor Cooper a veto, so it would be left up to the courts to see if the maps hold up for the March primary, and the U.S. Supreme Court has shown no interest in blocking partisan gerrymandering. The clock is ticking. With the December filing deadline for candidates just a month away, local and state elections boards will barely have enough time to ensure folks are running in the right district. lawsuits filed last week by the Southern Coalition for Social Justice on behalf of the NAACP in North Carolina and Common Cause seek to delay the primary, claiming the draft maps violate the Voting Rights Act because Republicans did not use racial data to draw new districts. You can't protect the rights of black voters without knowing where they are, said Attorney Mitchell Brown, representing the plaintiffs. Just because you stick in your head in the ground, he says, saying you are going to ignore race doesn't mean that you are not being racist. To ignore race is to ignore black voters' humanity. Litigation over the state's voting maps has been the status quo for the last four decades, and there hasn't been a complete set of maps since the 1980s. The most recent legal battle over Republican-drawn maps in 2011 spanned the last decade, and maps that were later ruled unconstitutional were used in the previous four elections. Republicans have been brazen in defense of their partisan maps. As former GOP Representative David Lewis said in 2016, electing Republicans is better than electing Democrats, so I drew this map to help foster what I think is better for the country. He said, I propose we draw the maps to give a partisan advantage to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, because I don't believe it's possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats. Lewis, who resigned from the legislature amid scandal and was sentenced to campaign finance fraud this summer, may finally get his wish. In a year with strong Republican turnout, the GOP could have an 11-3 majority in Congress, based on the current maps. The best outcome for Democrats would be an 8-6 split in favor of Republicans. One of the so-called competitive districts would include portions of the Triangle in southern Wake County, which swings predominantly Democrat. That district stretches through rural areas to the Triad, nearly 100 miles away. Overall, the state's three largest metro areas were cut to merge hundreds of thousands of urban voters with Republican-leaning rural areas. The maps completely remade Democratic Congresswoman Kathy Manning's district, which covers Greensboro and Winston-Salem. She lambasted the proposed new district boundaries as extreme partisan gerrymandering, with the aim of recapturing Republican control of the U.S. House. She said in a statement, under these maps, Guilford County is split into three congressional districts, diluting the interests of my constituents and lumping them in with far-flung counties in the Western Mountains, the suburb of Charlotte, and as far east as Wake County. These maps don't acknowledge that the Triad is a region with shared interests, concerns, and needs. During the committee hearing, Senate Minority Leader Dan Blue said the migration of more than 1 million voters in Wake, Mecklenburg, and Guilford counties defies common sense. He said this kind of radical, extreme effort simply takes us out of the process, and I think that you are convinced, as I am, it's not going to stand. So why don't we fix it right while we still have the opportunity to do it and not be governed by what interest outside of North Carolina tells we ought to be doing in handling North Carolina business? The request fell on deaf ears. Relying on the slow pace of the courts has played to Republicans' advantage in the past. Michael Bitzer, professor of history and politics at Catawba College, says we have seen in the past elections move forward even under challenged maps. The likelihood is, if past is any prologue, we will continue onward with the elections, just shifting the fight to the courts from the legislature. That's precisely why the Southern Coalition for Social Justice filed its lawsuits before the maps even received the legislative rubber stamp, hoping to place an injunction and delay the primary until new maps can be drawn. The objection isn't to the maps themselves, but rather the process used. By not including a racial polarization study in the GOP's consideration of these districts, the lawsuits claim, quote, the districts will dilute the voting power of black North Carolinians and diminish the ability of voters of color to elect the candidate of their choice. Republicans disagree, arguing that they weren't required to consult racial data in the process. The lawsuit's plaintiffs are using race as a sort of catch-22, said Republican State Senator Ralph Heiss. The, quote, the Southern Coalition for Social Justice sued us previously because we used race, and now they're suing us because we didn't use race, Heiss told the NNO. The only constant here is finding any excuse to sue to gain partisan advantage, no matter how contradictory, and they're doing it before the maps have even been considered by a legislative committee. Brown, the plaintiff's attorney, says they're hoping for a hearing on the request for injunction before the end of the month. That leaves a tight timeline for local and state election boards to enact the changes, says Jerry Cohen, former special counsel to the General Assembly, who serves on the Wake County Board of Elections. Cohen says the work is tedious and can take hours for each divided precinct. Aside from making sure candidates are running in the right district, the board also has to make sure the correct absentee ballots are mailed to residents, which are required to go out by January 12. He says it's a lot of work, and presumably that has to get done right away. The State House Redistricting Committee toiled over the maps late into the night Monday, accepting only a handful of amendments from Democrats. The Senate Redistricting Committee was expected to pass its own version Tuesday. It had not done so by the time Indy went to print. But tensions were already at a boiling point on Monday, after House Speaker Tim Moore confirmed there would not be a vote on the map at the night's 7 p.m. sessions. Most Democrats walked out of the chambers. Republicans then appointed Donnie Loftus, a Gaston County Republican, who attended the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, as the House's newest member. Bitzer says redistricting is the most political activity in American politics these days. When you have this level of polarization and partisan divide, and the fact that we, the voters, have sorted ourselves into communities that tend to vote overwhelmingly for one party over the other, this is what you get. Next, from Durham, Tomasi McDonald's safety skeptics. In the lead-up to Durham's municipal election this week, a mailer went out to Durham residents that read, "Murders up 54%, rapes 14%, don't defund the police." David Smith, secretary and a former president of Friends of Durham, one of the city's top political action committees, was behind the mailer. Smith, a Durham native, says he is skeptical of the Bull City's new Community Safety Department, CSD, that seeks to reimagine law enforcement. He says the idea might be a good one, I just don't know how it will be implemented. They were going to do traffic at first, but found out they had to have police present. They wanted to do domestic violence, but they're not going to do that either. The city's website notes that sending trained civilian responders to minor traffic accidents or abandoned vehicles requires approval from the state of North Carolina. Smith added that with the rise in crime over the past year, support for law enforcement is realistic. "I think the best way to handle crime is through the police," he says. Smith's views are in line with trends of decreased support, both nationally and locally, for defunding the police, and a marked increase in deadly gun violence. Still, Durham continues in its quest to reimagine policing. The CSD is currently seeking social workers, peer support specialists, licensed clinicians, counselors, health workers, mental health professionals, and paramedics. The new department won't become operational until next year, but its goal of dispatching first responders at times without police or firefighters is already receiving some negative previews. Even before George Floyd's death, a multiracial group of millennial activists in Durham were among the first in the country to demand defunding the police department as an end to the prison pipeline. The CSD, along with the city's Public Safety and Wellness Task Force, were born out of the pandemic and Black Lives Matter protests. Durham's decision to invest in evidence-based public safety programs that would take money out of police department coffers is happening during a tenuous time. Support for rethinking public safety following the deaths of Black people at the hands of police has waned, with the increase in violent crime in cities and towns across the United States. Despite calling for police reforms dating back to the Obama administration last week. The Pew Research Center reported that with the increase in violent crime, blacks and Hispanics are much less likely to prefer decreased police budgets in their communities. According to the poll, 47% of all adults say spending on policing in their communities should be increased. That's up from 31% in June of 2020. The poll also shows that 23% of African-American adults and 16% of Hispanics are less likely to favor defunding the police. Last year, 42% of black adults and 24% of Hispanic wanted a decrease in law enforcement funding after Floyd's death. The Pew poll mirrors a recent Washington Post report of mayoral candidates across the country voicing support to restore law and order, even in liberal cities. Here in Durham, where black men and boys account for well over 95% of the city's gun violence victims and perpetrators, the past functions as prologue by those who are calling for more police officers in embattled communities like McDougal Terrace, Southside, Oxford Manor, or Liberty and Elm Street, that are already prone to outbreaks of deadly violence. Nearly 40 years ago, the horrors of the crack cocaine epidemic destabilized entire neighborhoods and coarsened the soul of America. A great many black people across the United States and here in Durham supported former President Clinton's Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 that resulted in the mass incarceration of black and brown people. That unintended consequence should serve as a cautionary tale amidst renewed calls for more officer on the streets and potential over-policing of poor neighborhoods. Given the failure of a decades-long so-called war on drugs, it seems highly unlikely that flooding more police into Durham's most violent neighborhoods will dissuade people from shooting one another. With the creation of evidence-based approaches like the CSD and the expansion of a cure violence, quote, violence interrupters model, the Bull City, in the words of City Manager Wanda Page, has an opportunity to lead the way and find new, equitable, and innovative approaches to keep our community safe. Page noted that the city's concern with violent crime is balanced by the history of policing in America and its impact on people of color. She said the CSD, quote, reflects our belief that responding to the safety and wellness needs of all residents requires more than police officers, firefighters, and paramedics. Page said Durham still needs policing, but, quote, it's unfair to expect first responders to address every single issue our residents experience. As the Indy previously reported, the formation of the Bull City's CSD has its roots in the 2019 work of Durham Beyond Policing, BYP, a coalition of citywide nonprofits dedicated to divesting from policing and prisons. BYP lobbied for a public safety and wellness task force partnered by the city, county, and Durham Public Schools. At the crux of both the task force and CST's work is research conducted by the Research Triangle Institute in August of last year that did an in-depth analysis of 911 calls between 2017 and 2020. Researchers identified a number of 911 call types that could be responded to without an armed officer, including mental or behavioral health needs, traffic incidents, and quality of life issues. CSD Director Ryan Smith last week told Indy that the new agency has partnered with community groups and public officials to create a crisis call diversion and mobile crisis response pilots. Smith, in an email, said the crisis call diversion program, quote, will embed mental health clinicians into the 911 call center to triage and respond remotely to non-emergent, non-life-threatening calls for service. Meanwhile, he said the mobile crisis response unit, quote, will dispatch a team of trained, unarmed responders to a subset of 911 calls, involving behavioral and mental health needs and quality of life concerns. He said, it's premature to say how exactly these pilots will function. These programs are on schedule to be launched next year. Support for the CSD has been mixed, although the people who spoke with Indy last week, including Friends of Durham's David Smith, support the initiative in theory. Earlier this month, Donald Hughes, another Bull City native, told city council members he was dismayed by the city's plan to pay $6,000 to a poet laureate during a pandemic and deadly gun violence epidemic that all too often targets young black people. Hughes tells Indy that the community safety department is the direction the city should be headed in, but he worries that CSD's response to minor crisis scenarios could get out of hand. He said, I've been in a couple of traffic accidents that were minor, but tensions can flare. If the CSD is unarmed and can't handle the situation, who do you call? I've seen mental health situations where someone grabs a weapon. It seems the plan is missing some important steps. He adds that it's not about pitting the police against the CSD. He explains it's not either or, but both and. He continues, I've worked in government. When we start talking about reducing police budgets, there are the unintended consequences of having fewer officers. The folks who are left are overworked, and that affects their level of response because they are tired. Hughes says he thinks the city should listen more to people who live in the communities most impacted by violent crime and ask them, if you could control the police budget, what would you do? The new program members have been listening. Isaac Villegas, Mennonite pastor and president of the governing board of the North Carolina Council of Churches, is a task force member. Nearly 132 residents participated in a virtual town hall this month, co-hosted by the task force and the CSD. The overwhelming majority of participants want first responders who are compassionate, experienced with trauma, and trained in de-escalation. Villegas said residents who want to live in safe communities, free of police mistakes, cut across all demographics. Jennifer Carroll is an associate professor of anthropology at NC State University who formerly worked with the Atlanta, Carolina's high-intensity drug trafficking area, where she helped guide the Centers for Disease Control's overdose response strategy. In December, the city appointed Carroll to serve as the public policy expert for its Public Safety and Wellness Task Force. That task force charge includes reliance on, quote, community-based prevention, intervention, and re-entry services as alternatives to police and the criminal legal system, according to the city's website. Carroll says the public's uncertainty about the CSD is normal and says it's important because that worry reflects a community need. And she adds that in marginalized community, the police presence is evidence of the residents' financial investment in the places where they reside and the perception that they have not been abandoned. Carroll notes that people are taught at the very early age to call 911 for the police whenever they're in trouble. Now we're calling the police for everything we need, she says. The task force is asking, what do we actually need? She says initiatives like the city's task force and community safety departments aren't meant to supplant the police department, but to ease the officers' responsibilities by supplementing and adding more appropriate responses to crisis events. Carroll says most police officers joined law enforcement for two reasons, to get the bad guys and to help people. We can support that, she says. Xavier Casson, who co-chairs the task force, says the plurality of opinion about public safety is largely based on one's personal experiences with the police and research about the impact of law enforcement. He told the Indy this week, the question for me is how do we make actionable what has been researched with what has been people's lived experience? He counsels a wait-and-see attitude with the CSD and other initiatives that are starting on a small scale and possibly scaling up if effective. The CSD is very new, he added, and still in the stage of just listening. Now, from Jasmine Gallup, the second part of a two-part series on housing in the Triangle. After 8 months of viewings, dozens of bids, and thousands of dollars, Tina Love Hinton got the keys to her first home on August the 16th. At that moment, she felt profound relief. A mother of five told the Indy, "I was ecstatic, overwhelmed, but mostly relieved to finally have a home for my children. It's a process I never want to go through again." As mentioned in part one of Indy Week's series on the local housing market, tax relief, rent control, and affordable housing preservation could help many people stay in their homes. But for people looking to buy a new home in Raleigh or elsewhere in the Triangle, there's another problem. They simply can't afford it. Love Hinton started looking for a home in January, she says, but even in places like Dunn and Angier, fairly far to the south of Raleigh, the persistent housing shortage, inflated prices, and created competition impossible for her to beat. She said, "I wanted to stay in Harnett County where I was born and raised, but the housing market was crazy. You have people from various places upstate, Connecticut, New York, who are coming down here with cash. They aren't playing either. Some people have outbid me by $30,000 or $40,000. For those making less than $70,000 a year, it can be a struggle to afford the monthly mortgage in Raleigh or Durham. Against corporations with a lot of cash on hand, like Zillow or Open Door, Samuel Gunter, executive director of the NC Housing Coalition, says, individual families don't have a prayer of winning a bidding war. What we're seeing in Charlotte, for instance, is a hedge fund essentially buying up swaths of single-family homes and turning them into rentals, pulling them out of the home ownership market entirely, which is a concern. Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin says the solution is to increase supply. Earlier this year, the City Council approved a change to the zoning code allowing the construction of duplexes, townhouses, and apartments in areas where, previously, only single-family homes were allowed. The hope is builders will construct lower-priced townhomes throughout the city, creating a gateway to home ownership, Baldwin says. Durham enacted a similar zoning change in 2019 to allow denser housing near downtown. The cities are following the lead of other growing metropolitan areas like Minneapolis and Grand Rapids, Michigan, which each changed local laws to encourage multi-use and mixed-income developments. Oregon, in a more aggressive move, eliminated single-family zoning entirely in cities with more than 10,000 people. These changes have been successful in building up more housing stock, but haven't necessarily made houses more affordable. With so much demand, there's little incentive for developers to build low-rent apartments or entry-level homes that cost less than $200,000, says Gunter. It's simply not profitable. One solution Chapel Hill and other cities have considered is inclusionary zoning, which requires developers to build affordable housing as part of larger projects. Chapel Hill's inclusionary housing program, enacted in 2011, requires projects with more than 5 units to reserve 15% of those units for low to moderate income households. Baldwin, however, doesn't think these policies do enough to help solve housing problems. In a $1 million inclusionary zoning development, the city might get 5 affordable housing units, she says. If that money was instead given directly to the construction of affordable housing, it could result in more than 50 units. And she says, inclusionary zoning sounds good, but it doesn't have the impact that other means do. If you look at how many units Chapel Hill has built over the past 10 years with that method, it's not many. It might be 200 units. In fact, developers have committed to building 183 units since the town implemented that zoning ordinance, says Emily Holt, affordable housing development officer. Holt noted that the law simply formalized an affordable housing policy the town put in place in 2000. Since then, developers have committed to building 500 affordable units, built 281, and the town has received $4.9 million from developers allocated for affordable housing, she said. The town could maybe do more, but the state's ban on rent control prevents it from using inclusionary zoning for rental projects. It applies to houses only. She says, after the recession in 2008 and 2009, the housing market shifted away from building for sale units and has focused heavily on the construction of rental projects, which is likely one of the main reasons for the decrease in affordable home ownership units created in private development over the last 10 plus years. Inclusionary zoning can also be voluntary, with city officials offering incentives like allowing denser and more profitable developments in return for affordable housing. By waiving some of the regulations that make projects cost prohibitive, developers may be more willing to build affordable housing. In Austin, city council members created a program that allowed developers of affordable projects to bypass parking minimums, setback requirements, and height limits. Since that program started in 2019, more than 2,300 new affordable housing units have been planned. Mayor Baldwin says Raleigh has already eliminated parking minimums downtown, and she says we're looking to expand that in other areas of the city. The city council is also seeking the advice of the Urban Land and Institute on what tools are the most effective in incentivizing developers to build affordable housing. A committee to advise the city on potential incentives is in the works. Regardless of the program, the key to success is how it's administered, says Stacy Betancourt, a housing advocacy organizer with the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. In her experience, states and cities that make the most impact in housing are those that first create programs targeting the most vulnerable people, those who are homeless, or making extremely low incomes at or below 30% of area median income. Raleigh does have programs aimed at helping such residents. About $28 million, 35% of that $80 million affordable housing bond voters approved in November, is earmarked for nonprofit housing projects that will help some of Raleigh's most vulnerable residents, Baldwin said. This year, $3 million went to expand Healing Transitions Men's Campus, which helps men and women suffering from addiction, Baldwin says. Another $7 million will go to CASA, C-A-S-A, Kings Ridge Apartments, a 100-unit development that includes supportive services. Much of the focus right now, however, is on increasing the supply of housing for middle-income people like teachers, police officers, and healthcare workers. Chapel Hill's inclusionary zoning program, for example, targets those who make less than 80% of the area median income. The same is true of Raleigh's effort to increase housing supply. New units built as a result of changes to zoning laws have no income limits, so they may more often go to people who make more money and can afford to make a higher offer. Rhett Fussell, interim director of the Raleigh Area Land Trust, says programs targeting missing middle housing are just one step towards solving the affordable housing crisis. The Community Land Trust, which started a few years ago, builds houses reserved for people making 50 to 80% of area median income. Fussell says there are middle-income people who don't qualify for government subsidies or programs, but they can't afford a market-rate house. Teachers, policemen, retail workers, it's those folks we're trying to serve. He recognizes there's still a huge need among people making less than 30% area median, but at the same time there are already programs in place to serve them. Additionally, by helping middle-class earners buy homes, the land trust can free up lower-cost rental units for those that need them, he says. Quote, the land trust provides another option for affordable housing in the county, an option that doesn't exist presently. We're not going to solve this problem, but we want to be part of a potential solution. The work of the Raleigh Area Land Trust and Raleigh's nonprofit housing projects each follow Betancourt's second suggestion for successful programs, prioritizing permanent housing. Many affordable housing programs are short-term, requiring that units remain available to low-income people only for 3 to 5 years. After that, the units revert to unaffordable market rates. The expansion of Healing Transitions Men's Campus and Casa Kings Ridge Apartments, on the other hand, creates affordable housing that will remain in place for decades. Likewise, the creation of affordable homes by community land trusts is long-term, Fussell says. It provides for a better investment of public funds. The land trust can guarantee long-term affordability because we own it forever. We have 99-year leases on the properties. Anytime they're sold, they can't be sold at market rate. One other tool to create permanently affordable units is land acquisition, Baldwin says. About $16 million from that housing bond will go toward buying land near major highways and roads, a strategy that will put the city council in control of any future development in those areas. She says, when you own the property, you can be the one to say, we want affordable housing here. If we can develop along transit lines, that means we're providing even more affordable housing because people won't need to own a car. They can take public transportation. With the help of the affordable housing bond, Raleigh aims to build 5,700 new affordable housing units by 2026. Open to people making from between 30 to 80% of area median income. Despite officials' work to increase housing density in the and supply in the past 2 years, they're still lagging behind. As of 2019, Raleigh had a deficit of more than 28,000 affordable rental homes, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Baldwin admits Raleigh is playing catch-up. Like the whole country is, she says. I don't think people understood the implications of not wanting to build denser housing. I've always told people we're not going to buy our way out of this. We recognize that we have to build more. Much of the delay was due to infighting on the Raleigh City Council. Until 2019, when a new majority was voted into office, most city council members opposed new development, criticizing the construction of skyscrapers and big apartment buildings, they said, destroyed the character of the city. Criticisms were also levied at large projects for not including enough investment in affordable housing. Although cities like Raleigh and Durham are now taking action, led by a new core of officials who argue increased development decreases prices, affordable housing programs throughout the state are scattered and relatively small scale. Ultimately, the answer may be statewide change. When in power, local officials can make changes that have a significant effect on the affordable housing crisis. These changes, however, are not always lasting. As soon as the next cohort of city council members is elected, policies can be reversed. Some solutions that have proven effective elsewhere include state-imposed penalties for cities that don't allow enough housing production, those that limit development too strictly, and a statewide ban on income discrimination, which would prevent landlords from denying rental application if a renter was dependent on Social Security, for example. Another big policy tool is the State Housing Trust Fund. Some counties like Wake are already putting aside money for the preservation and production of affordable housing. Likewise, Asheville and Charlotte established housing trust funds in the early 2000s that provide financing to developers that build affordable housing. A state housing trust fund would expand these initiatives to work across North Carolina, tackling the affordable housing problem at scale. Still, Betancourt says, No state has the resources to end homelessness without significant federal commitment for established, proven solutions. There are lots of things states can do to move the needle, but nobody is getting it done. Federal investment in affordable homes is the best solution because that is the only type of intervention with the scale of resources necessary to address homelessness. Well, I may have a chance to finish this feature article called Hog Hell. I'm not sure. I'll do my best. This is the second part in a two-part series. In the mid-1990s, Billy Kinlaw purchased land in a remote, mostly black section of White Oak, a rural community of just 350 people in Bladen County. Kinlaw, who is white, never intended to live there. This property was strictly a business investment for his contract hog-growing operation for Murphy Brown, that's the Smithfield Foods subsidiary. Before long, Kinlaw Farms had more than 14,000 hogs in a dozen swine houses surrounded by three waste lagoons on nearly 300 acres. The surrounding families, most of whom had lived there for generations, had to endure everything that comes with an industrial hog operation of that size. The flies, buzzards, and endless sounds of pigs squealing. In addition to the animals came the noise and disruption from the parade of heavy trucks rumbling down unpaved roads and the minute particles of feces that marred homes, cars, mailboxes, and laundry from hog waste, flushed into open lagoons and sprayed onto feed crops as fertilizer, and the stench. Oh, God, the stench. After 20 years, Joyce Loretha Richardson McIver had had enough. In 2014, the then 80-year-old became the lead plaintiff in Joyce McIver versus Murphy Brown LLC, one of 26 federal nuisance lawsuits brought against the company by more than 500 plaintiffs, the majority of them black. Juries in five trials in 2018 and 19 awarded 36 plaintiffs a total of almost $550 million, a number that was quickly whittled down to about $98 million because of a state law that caps punitive damages. But on January 31st, 2020, Virginia defense attorney Stuart Raphael arrived at the Italianate Lewis F. Powell Jr. Courthouse in Richmond to ask the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals for a do-over. Raphael argued that even the $3.25 million awarded to the plaintiffs in McIver case was excessive because, as he put it, quote, Murphy Brown's conduct has not been willful and wanton. During the questioning, Reagan-appointed Judge Harvey Wilkinson III gave a hint of the ruling that would come 9 months later. He suggested that plaintiffs were being made to suffer under conditions that also impacted their health because they lacked political influence and didn't live in what he called McMansions. In November 2020, the three-judge panel rejected Smithfield's call for a retrial and most of its arguments. Writing for the majority, U.S. Circuit Court Judge Stephanie Thacker said the company had persisted in its chosen farming practices despite its knowledge of the harms to its neighbors, exhibiting wanton or willful disregard of the neighbor's right to enjoyment of their property. The lower court verdict would stand. North Carolina became an innovator in industrialized pork production and the fastest-growing swine-producing state in the country when Smithfield moved into Bladen County in 1992. Legislators and investors were not dissuaded by environmentalists who warned that building a receptacle for huge piles of hog waste filled with hazardous contaminants in a floodplain probably wasn't the best idea. When Hurricane Floyd brought life-threatening and catastrophic flooding ashore in 1999, floodwaters breached the lagoons and transformed coastal rural communities like the McIvers into seas of dead hogs, chickens, and turkeys and their toxic waste. 2 years earlier, the industry's explosive growth had prompted the state to place a moratorium on expansion, sort of. It prevented companies from building new lagoons, but didn't force them to relocate from the floodplains or to remediate old ones. After Floyd, then Governor Jim Hunt said the hog lagoons had to be gone in a decade. The following year, Smithfield Foods signed an agreement with the state promising to avoid this kind of environmental calamity in the future by developing, quote, environmentally superior waste technologies. Yet more than 20 years later, the lagoons are still there. What happened during Floyd happened again in 2016 during Hurricane Matthew and in 2018 during Florence, albeit on a smaller scale. That's because the 2000 agreement to eliminate the lagoons contained a loophole so big, Smithfield has been driving eight-wheeled hog haulers through it ever since, said Ryan Reich Longest, co-director of the Environmental Law and Policy Clinic at Duke University School of Law. Quote, Smithfield got off the hook because they were able to point to this clause in the contract that said that they had to fix the problems in a way that was economically feasible. He said, they can't put on new pollution controls because their prices are still the same, and that's not economically feasible for them. Longest compares the outdated years-old process Smithfield continues to use to fitting a car with a tailpipe when a catalytic converter is readily available. He said the systems that they're using were designed in some cases 30 or 40 years ago. They are allowed to continue to operate under a grandfathering provision under some assumptions that have never really been tested that these things would not leak or cause significant groundwater or other pollution concerns. The scientific evidence is that they do leak. The amount of waste getting off the farm into the groundwater looks to be very significant. From 2,000 feet up, it's clear the fields surrounding the farms are saturated with sludge pumped from the lagoons that greatly exceeds what's needed to fertilize the crops. Instead of being absorbed, it pools. Some amount of it eventually runs off into nearby creeks, streams, and watersheds. Kemp Burdett, the Cape Fear Riverkeeper, says, we've been sampling streams that run off the spray field of those facilities. One has had levels of bacteria and nutrients so high it's been placed on an EPA list of water bodies that are so polluted they're not able to meet their designated uses. It's hard to keep track of the number of lawsuits, complaints, EPA filings, and administrative challenges that have taken place since industrial hog farming started to dominate the state's economy more than 30 years ago. Allegations of racism and environmental injustices have been at the heart of many of these battles. Several studies have shown that Black, Latino, and Indigenous populations where the hog farms are located have been disproportionately impacted by these practices. Well, I must stop reading now, but IndieWeek.com, available free online, contains several articles that I couldn't reach today to read to you. They include an award-winning coffee roaster right here in Durham, mental health challenges to the music industry, a new music release by Al Riggs, a debut memoir by Julia Ridley Smith, and a music review about the French Dispatch. But this week's issue can be found on our website, ncreadingservice.org. You can replay bits of it that I did get to. And who am I? I'm John Fetterson, and we'll be back in a week with you with the Indie Week. And thanks for listening, everybody.